On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I am Tim Polari here today in the Crawl Space Studios with Lance Reinsteer. Now, Lance, how are you?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing great. You're back.
I am back.
It's been a while.
It's been a few weeks. It's been 6 weeks.
Yeah. How was your time away?
It was good. I learned a lot about myself and about, you know, the world outside of true crime.
Are you going to tell us what you were doing?
I was working on a movie set.
What movie?
It's a movie called I Care a Lot. That title might change in the future, but working title is I Care a Lot.
Oh, very cool. Well, cool. That'll be a lot of fun. That's going to be a theatrical release. Where is that going?
Yeah, it's going to be a theatrical release probably next year, but I mean, they don't give people like myself the inside info.
Yeah. Was it super exciting?
Yeah, it was pretty arduous and long hours, but no, like I said, learned a lot about the industry, and it was interesting to be outside of this world looking in for a change.
Yeah, and I think most of our listeners have probably never been on a film set, so the old saying is the first day you're on a film set is the most exciting day of your life.
But, I don't know.
Here's the full saying. The second day on a movie set is the most boring day of your life.
I will say that it was never boring.
Yeah, okay. All right, so we're going to get into some Ask Me Anything questions that we promised like 2 months ago and didn't record then, but here we are. It's a bonus episode. You're getting it for free, for bonus. Here it is. Here's an email from Tori from Massachusetts. She said, I attended UMass Amherst as a freshman in 2003 and 2004, and my sister was a senior there that year. I'm so sad to say that we really didn't know much of anything about the case until we started listening to your podcast about a year ago, but that's not why I'm writing you. I have a theory about this house where the two cadaver dogs hit in the same spot. I feel like it's possible that Maura or someone was buried slash hidden in that basement, and the owners wouldn't let Fred or anyone in to search because they were hiding her body. Once the heat wasn't on them, they were able to remove and dispose of her body elsewhere, and then they covered it with concrete and sold the house and got away with it. Maybe the cadaver dogs hit on where she was buried, but she was gone by then. Do you know who the previous homeowners were or where they went? I'm assuming they wouldn't still cooperate with the investigation, but I'm surprised I haven't heard this theory come up on your podcast from anyone else before, unless I missed it. I'm curious to hear your take on this. And she's praying that the Murray family gets some answers soon. So, Tori, thank you very much for the email. We appreciate it. What do you think about this one, Lance?
Well, the question is, do you know who the previous homeowners were, where they went? That's the question?
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. I don't know where they went.
Yeah.
We do know who they were.
Right. And we're not really obligated. We don't have the liberties to say who they are. I don't want to give up anyone's personal privacy.
Right. I mean, I suppose we could, but
we could.
I mean, it's out there. If you look for it, you could find it. I mean, I don't think there's anything illegal about saying it at this point, but you're going to get people throwing stones at them potentially for no reason. Now, do we believe Maura was in that house? I don't know. I really don't know. I know there's discrepancies. I know the dogs hit there. The Murray-led search cadaver dogs hit there. The dog Eisen that we met doesn't seem like Eisen's got his head up his butt, Lance. Eisen seems like he's on it.
I think that what she's also indicating here is that perhaps there was a body there that could have been removed, before the dogs were able to come in during the Murray search. And I think that that's possible with cadaver dogs. They might be able to hit on a place that had a body there at one point. Again, not entirely sure the details of where they hit. We heard, you know, an area where they hit. We don't know the surrounding areas. We talked a lot about maybe there was some graveyard or some sort of, like, you know, washout from a graveyard that might have brought in some confusion with the dog. So they might have got caught a whiff of something that had been previously dead for a while that might have maybe washed out underneath the house. I mean, these are old, it's an old area.
Yeah.
Could have been anything. I mean, all of that said, like, this is very, very close to where Maura went missing, and would love to speculate more about it. I mean, the theories are all out there, and you can really easily come up with a theory. I hope I'm doing justice to the answer here, but it's just very hard to answer.
Yeah. I don't know. I wish I knew more too. Really don't. It's hard to answer. It's hard to answer that. We'd never been in the house. We didn't speak to the new or old owners.
Yeah. And there's a lot of communication that still goes on between us and the family, and even, you know, Maggie and Art, and they talk to law enforcement up there in New Hampshire. So if anything does come out, we will cover that as best we can and as responsibly as we can.
Okay. Here's one from Chastity. She said she's been listening since episode 1, but just finished up to episode 97. And she said she believes it was episode 95, but we were talking about a guy finding a backpack behind bathrooms. I was confused and driving while listening, but I didn't understand what y'all was saying. They found it, but turned out to be blue. I'm not really sure now either. I guess there was a backpack that was found in the woods, not super close to where Maura went missing, not like in that general vicinity, and that was found and turned into the police. But we are led to believe at this point that it's not Maura's, because they probably would have said that it was.
And we're talking about the backpack that was found
Back Lake, I think.
Yeah, Back Lake or Back Mountain or something, and it was by a fire tower or something. It's really tough sometimes to untangle the rumors, and I mean, they get conflated all the time. There was that moment about a year ago, I'm going to guess, where this guy found this thing that was sunk in the river. Remember that? And they forwarded it to Chuck and to Art, and they, because it contained clothing and other objects, and they thought it might have something to do with Maura. So I think that gets a bit conflated as well with other things that were found along in the course of this search. But those two findings are, 10 years apart, more than 10 years apart. So we know that Maura had a backpack. We know that a blue backpack was, we don't even know if it was blue. Could have been a black backpack. I think the color was not determined because of the time it had spent just sitting out in the open.
Yeah, I'm foggy on the details of the color at this point. Yeah.
Also, way to go, Chastity, on your name, first of all, and your questions. There's a lot of them, and they're great.
Yeah, and again, on the backpack, she says, you had said that there was a duffel bag in her car, but her family said that she carried a black backpack. And what color was the duffel bag? Could it be shaped like a backpack? I guess I don't know. I mean, that would have been nice to know, I guess, but I don't know that one.
Yeah, it was like a gym bag. Is that what we're calling a duffel bag?
I don't know. These are pretty detailed questions.
Pretty detailed questions.
She says, sadly, I don't think she was going to commit suicide, just going to blow off steam, and was met with foul play. Heartbreaking. I cannot imagine the pain of not knowing. As a parent, I don't care if it's every possibility they're no longer with us, but it's just that glimmer of hope out there that the child is there. That's more devastating to wake up to day after day.
I just want to read a couple of other questions that she had. She asked about the coordinates that were featured on the Oxygen show, and if there was anything there, and if any cadaver dogs have been taken to the area to check. No, to our knowledge, cadaver dogs have not been taken up there. Even for dogs, it would be a bit rough for them to get up there and come down and then go out into the woods to check. I don't think a dog could even walk through the overbrush that's happening once you leave the trail and you go out to the coordinates. Nothing was ever found there. As far as we know, it was just some online prank that needed to be checked out. And on top of that question about the Oxygen show, she wants to know about the A-frame house and it lit up from the luminol. And has that ever been explained? We went in there with our own testing of the luminol and nothing lit up.
Well, we didn't really do the luminol right.
We didn't do the luminol correctly. So there was never any explanation on that one.
Not to us. Yeah. Yeah. We heard from the old owner who said that he tried the luminol, who is a professional law enforcement, professional in a different sort of, pocket of law enforcement, but he did try it and he has had experience with it. And that's what he said. Now we've heard a lot of things about luminol. Luminol can give false readings for certain cleaning products, even.
Yeah,
so,
like bleach.
Yeah, so that might be where the answer lies in the luminol glowing inside the closet in the A-frame.
And yeah, the concrete that was poured was never recorded in the land records. I'm assuming we're talking about the one on the A-frame house, that slab of concrete. Numerous tests have been done with that. There have been no biological material underneath the surface, and it really looks like something was set up there, possibly like a tower, like a little like fire tower or something like that.
Yeah.
The footprint of the holes that are in the concrete are very similar to that of like a fire tower. So there's nothing underneath. I mean, it's in a weird spot, but if you take out that house and you put a fire tower there, like, I'm not even sure when the fire tower would have been there, but it doesn't feel as weird once you're looking at it and you don't look at the house. You look at the positioning of the slab. Yeah, there could have been a fire tower there.
Hunting tower,
possible. Maybe.
Yeah. Here's one from Curtis. He says, not Curtis Murray. He said, I wanted to first thank you guys for the time and effort you put into the podcast/show. He says, my daughter is a freshman in college at UCF, and she basically decided to be a lawyer because of the Innocence Project and true crime shows like yours. Well, that's
nice.
Amazing. Yeah. Your show, outside of all the good work and attention it has brought to the case, is something that my daughter and I now share, and it has been a blessing. After watching the Oxygen documentary and listening to your podcast for about 2 weeks, I declared myself an expert on the subject of Maura Murray and borderline a master detective. What fascinates me most about this case is that it's almost three cases in one. First, the days before she left, Maura seemed to be unraveling and a mess. Then the drive. Not many people just up and leave without telling anybody anything. Has she ever done that before? Just bounce for a couple days. Lastly, the accident. And he says, I won't even get into that because everything there is a question. But it seems like more of the focus on the accident and after. I can't really get past before the accident. Okay, so I see what he's saying. Has she ever left for a couple days before? I mean, we didn't know Maura, but there is a story of her leaving. I think it's skipping a day of high school, right? And going to Boston, taking the train or bus
into high
school.
I don't know if it was high school, but yeah. She definitely left during the week and went into Boston.
Yeah.
Well, that's the story we heard.
Yeah. I think that was in the Disappeared episode.
Yeah. And she was known to be an avid hiker, whether it was with her father or with her friends. It's not outside the realm of possibility that this was the first time she decided to go up to the White Mountains by herself. She'd been there numerous times. And I might disagree a little bit with someone saying that people just don't go off on their own. I think that happens more often than we are aware or consider.
Yeah, a good reminder to tell somebody where you're going if you are going away. Even if you're going away by yourself somewhere and you don't want people to know, it's very important to just tell at least one person, please. So Curtis goes on to say, I've been in produce sales since 2000. I've had a cell phone ever since. I remember back in 2004, I had a BlackBerry but didn't have navigation. Did Maura print up MapQuest directions to where she was actually going? Or maybe did she have a GPS machine in her car? And so Maura actually printed up directions to Burlington, Vermont, which is not where she ended up. So that's a bit perplexing to us. I think I spoke about it maybe on the last episode we did, that there is sort of a split when you're going up 91, and you can go one way towards Burlington, or you can stay on 91 that takes you into New Hampshire. And so some speculation was that maybe she got messed up at that highway interchange.
I think it's more simple. I think she didn't know where she was going, and she started heading north, and she had the printed up directions because she didn't know exactly how to get to Burlington, but she knew how to get to the White Mountains, and she probably just made up her mind when it came time to make that decision.
So you think she pivoted somewhere on the road?
Yeah, well, I think she made a decision to go to the White Mountains as opposed to Burlington.
After she had left her...
Yeah.
After her dorm, yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe she just printed it up as a possibility.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel like she got lost some way. I don't know if it was on the highway or afterwards, but... So Curtis says, I know Maura was busy with school and work, but was she dating anyone besides her long-distance boyfriend? Not that we know of, not that we've ever heard of. Something small, but I go up to New Hampshire yearly for summer vacation with the family and always stop at the rest stops by the Mass New Hampshire line where there are New Hampshire State liquor stores and lotto because of the taxes. And he says, the reason I bring that up is because if I'm knowingly taking a long drive, I usually don't buy the alcohol until I get close to the destination. And Maura seemed to be going on a stakeout. I'm not sure what that means, but I do get what he's saying, right? There's no taxes at that New Hampshire liquor store. Is he saying it would be cheaper?
Yeah.
As opposed to buying it at the liquor store in Amherst?
Yeah.
Interesting. Wonder how much cheaper. Like, you're talking like $10 or something like that?
I mean, if you're going to buy in bulk, then it would make more sense to stop there.
She spent like 40-something bucks, though. Probably $5 at the most, though, you're probably talking.
I mean, that's just, I mean, considering that she remembered it was on the way.
Yeah.
I mean, he says that he went there often. Maura went there often as well, but she never went there alone. So I don't know if that was like the first thing that she was thinking. It was like, maybe she just wanted to get the alcohol. So, I mean, I can't speculate.
Yeah.
On that.
I also don't know if the New Hampshire liquor store is present off of 91. I know it's present off of 93.
Yeah, it's 93. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't recall seeing it on 91.
I don't think it is.
Yeah. So maybe that's the answer there. And then he says, is there any connection between her and her friends and anyone on the Haverhill police force? Not that we know of. He says, like some young cop at the time meeting her at a UMass party. Definitely not that we have ever heard of. And has she ever gone with family or friends on that road before? Again, not that we ever know of. Fred Murray, her dad, likes to think that she was headed to Bartlett and that's why she was on that road.
You're talking route. Route 112.
Yeah, Route 112, that she was crossing over from 91 where she went north up there and got off and took Route 112 that would get you over to the 93 side and potentially on your way to Bartlett.
I mean, according to Fred, I believe, well, she went to Jigger Johnson.
Yeah.
And I believe you'd need to go 112 to get to Jigger Johnson.
Is that close? Is that right by there?
Jigger Johnson Campground is actually on 112 on the other side of Lincoln.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So
you'd be crossing, if you're going up 91, you'd be crossing Lincoln through 112 to get to Jigger Johnson.
So you'd take 112 from where you get off of 91 all the way east, all the way past 93 and past Lincoln.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
It's close to Mount Kerrigan.
And here's one from Shelley from Dacula, Georgia, which is Dracula without the R. She says, follower of Maura's story for a few years, read the books, watched the shows, listened to the podcasts. Love you guys here and on Crawl Space. Thank you, Shelley. Shout out, Shelley. She says, thanks for keeping Maura's story alive. My question is, on a podcast or on here or somewhere, there was a mention once that I've heard of about Maura's alarm clock going off in her dorm room and that someone had to go in and turn it off. What time was it set for, and was it set for the day after she went missing? Was that the only time it happened? Interesting if it was set and she wasn't planning on returning. Yeah, I think that was in the episode that we did like a few months ago with Clint Harding.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I had heard it too, actually. And I don't really recall the details.
I don't know if anyone knows what time it went off.
Yeah.
But it was the next morning.
Yeah, it was shut off the next morning, right?
Yeah.
Someone went in there to shut it off.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew more on that, too. Here's one from Patrice. She said, hi, I just finished watching the first 4 episodes of Finding Maura Murray and wondering if there will be additional episodes. There was a preview for another at the end of episode 4. Where can I find it? I enjoyed the documentary immensely and am a regular listener of Crawl Space. Thank you. Thank you, Patrice. We don't have any more episodes of Finding Maura Murray ready yet. It is in the plans. It's just a matter of getting a little bit more time to edit it. And I know it's been a while since we've released some, closing in on a year. But we do still have a bunch of footage, and it is still in the plans. It's probably going to happen later this year or early next year. I don't know.
Got to figure out the bandwidth.
Yeah.
Speaking of shout-outs, we have shout-out Susan. She has a couple of really nice
she does.
Questions here. my mugging story. You're just going to have to stay tuned for that. I'm not going to get into it here. That's more of a special Patreon type event, if you will. Her third question is, did the police fully investigate Mora's track coach, Hussein Baghdadi? Did any of her friends or family know that she was seeing him? Was she still seeing him when she went missing? He is always stuck in my mind because he was part of the outing club and knew about the cabin, according to the man that you spoke to at the cabin. I felt that James Renner dismissed him too quickly. I don't recall having heard that the police verified an alibi, and that is why.
Well, okay. Yeah, so she's asking about Mora's old track coach, Hussein Baghdadi. Did any of her friends or family know that she was seeing him? Not that I know of, not that I'm aware of. I don't know if, has Julie ever answered that?
Yeah, I think they know of him now, but it was only after the fact. I don't think they knew while it was happening. And I think, and I could be wrong, but I think this was during the period of time when her and Bill were sort of on again, off again. So it was the assistant track coach, and it probably, as much as he shouldn't have been involved in a relationship with a student, it I don't really feel like it was as sort of illicit and lurid as people make it out to be. It was, I think it was short-lived from what we understand, and there were comments that he had given to, I believe, James Renner, where he had said, yeah, she had talked about, you know, running away or escaping or something. So a lot of people put that, you know, all in the mixed bag of his story and his involvement with Mora. And it does cast a little bit of a shadow, but you know, right now we know that he's got a really good career and a family, and he wants to stay isolated from this story. And I'm sure if there was anything that had to do with him and Mora's disappearance, the police would have figured it out at this point.
Yeah, I would definitely hope
so. I would hope so.
Yeah. And here, question number two, she asks. I think we can talk about this now, Lance.
Oh, sure.
She asks, what happened with the threatening letter when we were recording Empty Frames Season 1? And this is something that happened. Of course, Empty Frames is our art crime show. If you want to check that out, please do. Subscribe to Empty Frames wherever you're listening now. And Empty Frames Season 1 was on the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist of Boston in 1990. And we did get some threatening emails from someone who we had discussed in that season, and someone with a criminal record, and someone that we didn't really want to continue pissing off.
Yeah, I mean, this guy is always mentioned when people talk about the Gardner Museum heist. If you look into it even a little bit, even on the surface level, this guy's name comes up. So his name has been mentioned in a ton of things, but maybe he reaches out to everybody who mentions his name.
I don't know.
And threatens them in not so veiled ways. But
he said in email, he said, paintings aren't the only things that go missing.
Yeah.
And we were like, hello, have you not heard of missing Maura Murray? We're very familiar with missing people. Thank you.
And then he was suggesting that we wanted a thrill.
Oh, he did say something
like something
that.
Like that.
Yeah,
that
well, we're doing this because we're thrill seekers.
Looking for a thrill.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
I'll go skydiving if I want a thrill, buddy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, open wide. another one of his quotes.
Yes.
Anyway, thanks a lot, Susan. These are great, great questions. Shout out to you.
Shout out, Susan.
And you are also not disgusting.
And Susan is a patron of ours, and so for $5 a month, you get one piece of content per week over at Patreon. So check us out at patreon.com/crawlspacepodcast. We have a lot of fun over there. Here's one from Edward. He says, hello, I have two questions regarding Mora's case. The first is, can we confirm 100% that Mora was driving the Saturn and it wasn't a different woman? No, we cannot confirm that 100%.
I don't know how one would be able to confirm that 100%.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you were Mora, but I mean, 99.9 is the closest we can get to that. He says, the second question I have is, have you guys reached out to the Mind Shock podcast?
Ugh.
No, we haven't. Just kind of seen some nasty comments from them online, so we're not really working with them or anything like that.
However, if they want to have a conversation offline, feel free to shoot us an email.
Sure. Here's one from Jennifer. she says, hey guys, what happened to you guys covering the guys missing in Boston and the old case from the early 1900s? On Crawl Space, you were going to be discussing these cases from time to time, and I haven't heard anything about these.
I want to say that it's kind of a good thing that we haven't been covering the cases of the missing men in Boston. There hasn't been one in a little while, and they're so fresh. Like, when they happen, they're so new. It's really hard to do anything that is helpful if you're covering something that is like so new, and the families don't want this sort of attention. They want to figure out what happened to their kid. So,
yeah,
I mean, while we did promise these things, we covered it. If there's any new information on the old cases, we'll definitely bring that up. But any new ones that happen right now, if there's a missing person that happens to be in the Boston area, we'll definitely mention that. But it's not going to be an in-depth thing if you know, in the unfortunate circumstance that a body is found. Well, you just kind of have to be respectful and let things play out.
Yeah. We did speak to a woman named, I think her name is Ina, and she had a relative, I think it was her brother, who we had talked about on the show.
Yeah.
We spoke to her a few months ago, so that was something we were considering bringing you guys. Ina, if you're out there listening, hit us back up. We'll have you on the show.
Yeah. We started a good dialogue with her. I think that's when I just started thinking about it, that it, you know, this is like a heavy thing for people.
It's a hard case to cover, and especially when like a lot of it points to like, oh, a serial killer or like something paranormal, when it doesn't really seem like that is the case to us anyway.
Yeah. And I would hate it if it was my brother or, you know, and they're saying like, is it a smiley face killer thing or is it a paranormal thing?
Yeah.
We've learned a lot. We've learned a lot here. As far as the Dean murder in Jaffrey in 1918, we got some stuff planned, but God damn it, it gets busy here. We got some stuff planned. We have the transcripts from the grand jury hearing that took place back then, and we have some really good narrators who have taken these sections and they've read them, so there will be a release of these at some point. It's just, again, a matter of trying to find the old bandwidth to make it happen.
Yeah. So here's one from Luciana. She says, why do you think it is that some cases, such as Maura Murray, Amy Mihalovic, Brian Schaefer, Jacob Wetterling, provide or provoke so much attention, discussion, podcasts, and popularity, while there are so many other missing person, unidentified persons, and unsolved murders that are rarely mentioned? I think that's an interesting point.
I think it's super interesting, and I would love to have Maggie Freeling on to talk about her work that she does with the indigenous women, women of color, just all of these like minorities that go unnamed. The reason why these are popular are because they're relatable people. They're relatable to what we see every day, and they're incredible mysteries. They have no evidence, they have no trace. So that on top of it helps when inquisitive minds want to figure something out.
Yeah, it's when a type of situation where your imagination can kind of get a hold of you and take you somewhere. I think that's a big part of it. But I don't know. I mean, I do think it's an interesting question. Why do they provoke so much attention, podcasts? And I do think there's something in like the podcast sphere that kind of certain cases get caught up in like a windmill and kind of get repeated by podcasts. In this field, you know, I think that's happened a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a lot more appealing to look at someone like Brian Schaefer than someone who is a minority who is found on the streets of Baltimore or Chicago, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about the mystery, right?
I think it's a heavy combination of the mystery and them being relatable to you.
Mm. Me?
Well,
uh-oh.
I mean, you, the general
the royal
public.
You.
Yeah.
Here's one from Chris. He says, we know Maura was at least messing with the trunk of her car due to the witness statement, quote, a flurry of activity in the trunk, end quote. And the rag in the tailpipe was kept in the trunk. I believe it is very possible she climbed into the trunk to hide and likely succumbed to the elements as she could not escape that vehicle. As per the article, we know there was not a trunk release inside that model. Of car and inside the trunk. So this would mean that the police and or tow truck driver would have discovered and hidden the body. Would love to hear your thoughts and possible explanation on this. I don't believe it that Maura climbed in her trunk at all. I mean, I think he hits on the point, like, the tow truck driver or the police officer would have had to have hidden her body. I just think that's too far of a leap to go, because that person wouldn't have been guilty of anything. Why would they hide her body?
I think, again, what we keep bringing up is that to explore anything other than what we know isn't really going to get us anywhere. What we know is that there was a rag in the tailpipe, and we know that there was a flurry of activity at the trunk, and we know that Fred had told her what to do in case she wanted to stop the car from sputtering in situations. So all of that leads to her putting the rag in the tailpipe, and according to all of the other accounts, there's no indication that she got into the trunk or was forced into the trunk.
Yeah.
I mean, say what you will about the Westmans, Faith Westman, who had called it in and right across the street. I would like to think that if she had seen some sort of activity by the trunk right around that time that included someone putting Maura in the trunk, then she would have reported that.
Yeah.
Now, if it had happened like the police did it, or someone came along right after Butch was there and Faith just wasn't looking, I mean, you still have witness A pulling up at some point. Like,
yeah.
to put him in the trunk that quickly, to put someone in a trunk that quickly.
Or even if she did it herself.
Even if she did it herself. I mean, that's more of like a plausible thing for me, I guess, if we're going there. But I'm not. I mean, that's like, she's done nothing to indicate that she would be that dumb.
And she wasn't yelling while, you know, there was a couple hours of people around the car checking out the scene. Like, she wasn't yelling and screaming, "Help, get me out." So, yeah, I don't think the trunk has any validity to it.
I think it's exactly what we have always thought it was. She got the rag out of the trunk.
Yeah, I do. I do, too. From Shannon, she says, "I was wondering if the two of you have ever had a disagreement. You seem to get along quite well, but I'm sure there must have been instances where you have diverted in opinion or disagreed on an approach / theory / guest. Have you ever really disagreed, and how do you settle disagreements?"
You know, we could disagree just to create, like, tension for the listener, and that'd be fun, I guess, for the listener, but honestly, it's exhausting. Like, we just had a moment a few minutes ago where you thought that she was she got lost on her way up.
Yeah.
And in my head, I feel like it's more rational that somewhere along the line she made the decision to not go to Burlington. We could have a 20-minute argument about who's right, but you know what? No one's gonna be right.
Yeah.
Because we don't know.
So we
settle it with fisticuffs.
Yeah. Bare knuckle boxing.
Bare knuckle boxing, old school style, like the logo on the Notre Dame football helmet.
That's right. From Ramey. Ramey says, "The New Hampshire cold case unit has recently solved, among other cases, the Bear Brook murders from the 70s. This case has had a lot less information than Maura's case. The unit seems pretty amazing, but does this give you any hope for Maura's case to someday be solved by them?" Absolutely.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was more than one person or two people involved with Bear Brook?
Yeah.
And there were bodies found.
Yeah, bodies found in the barrels, but they didn't know who they were.
The problem with Maura's case is that there's zero.
Yeah.
And for all we know, a single person took Maura and did what only they know they did. And that's what makes it really tough.
And Ramey goes on here, says, "I am from New Hampshire, and I think that a billboard was discussed would do better probably up in the White Mountain region. I think we had spoken about doing it in Manchester. And I think that's a good point, but I think as we discussed here, that there are very few billboards in the state of New Hampshire at all. I think most of them are in the Manchester region."
Yeah, and while a billboard, and maybe I'm speaking on a contrary note here that people don't want to hear, but
can't wait to disagree with you.
Yeah. I don't really think a billboard will do much good.
Yeah.
I think money spent needs to go towards anything that can be brought as evidence that can be tested.
Yeah.
A billboard can do something if the person or persons responsible saw it and they start to get nervous. But after all of this attention that's on there, the TV show, the news, you know, the news pressers that just happened with the new searches, this show, Aaron's show, I mean, there's so much out there right now. I don't know what a billboard's going to do that's going to make somebody nervous.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just looking at it potentially, but more from Raimi. She says, any thoughts about Nathaniel Kibbe being involved in Mora's disappearance? He had kidnapped Abigail Hernandez in the same area of New Hampshire. Kibbe would have been about 19 at the time of Mora's disappearance.
That's pushing it for a serial killer.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely heard about this Nathaniel Kibbe and the Abigail Hernandez case, but haven't really tried to connect them very hard at all. I think, it's a little unlikely. I think, I mean, I also, you think in 15 years, right? So if this guy, you know, kidnapped Mora 15 years ago and then kidnapped Abigail Hernandez late, like 10, 15 years later, it just seems like there might have been more in the meantime, you know?
I think it's important to look at it and try to weed it out.
Yeah.
Take it out of the equation like you should do with Israel Keyes.
Yeah. Right.
Very, very interesting possibility, but from a step back you can see this probably isn't a realistic scenario, especially if you just simply look at the area in which she went missing.
She says there seems to be a lot of thoughts on why Mora wouldn't have run down Bradley Hill Road. Any reasons why?
I think because, I mean, my primary reason is the dogs didn't pick up any scent beyond that spot of Bradley Hill Road. I think if she had taken that right and went down the road, I feel like the dogs probably would have at least gone a little bit down that road.
And it's also up the hill from where Mora went missing. It would actually be up kind of a devastating hill, actually. Goes on for a long time. Several miles, I feel like. So that's not an easy hill to run up or walk up or anything.
Once you're on Bradley Hill.
Yeah, but Bradley Hill Road's pretty intense. Here's one from Rebecca. She says, so I'm listening to the CrimeCon episode now, and I don't actually have any questions, but I listened to your podcast through CastBox, shout out CastBox, and I just wanted to let you all know how much I appreciate your podcast that you include other missing persons cases. I love true crime podcasts, but it's so annoying to follow 50 different ones about 50 different missing people, so to have you guys do an episode about somebody else that is, you know, really refreshing. Also, on the theory that she ran to Canada, I doubt that if she ran away, it's probably to Delaware. Nobody ever looks in Delaware.
That's a good point.
Count it. Anyway, love your podcast. Thanks for the insight. Thank you, Rebecca. Really appreciate that. That's a really nice email. And we are covering other cases. We have been doing that for, I guess, a couple months now, and we're going to continue to do that here on this podcast, on this feed.
Sure thing. I mean, there's only so much that you can talk about with one case, and when you've established and nurtured a platform like this and you have a very loyal listener base and they're into trying to help with missing persons and unsolved cases, you might as well use this platform to put the word out there for as many things as possible in regards to missing people, unsolved cases, unidentified bodies. And once a Mora Murray update happens, the show will be 100% about Mora Murray. That episode will be about Mora Murray.
Yeah.
But we got a platform and it's time to try to use it in a more broad way.
Yeah. And speaking of other cases, we had Ledessa on, who was in a relationship with Brandon Lawson when he went missing. And this episode aired about a month ago. And we did get a lot of emails and questions on YouTube why we didn't ask Ledessa her interpretation of the 911 call. And I thought about this a little bit. And I think the reason why is because she started discussing a little bit of Brandon when he's in a paranoid mood, when he potentially is under the influence of something. And so she was describing exactly what's on that 911 call, basically. The behavior that he shows on that 911 call is what she was describing when he gets a certain amount of messed up. And so I think we kind of didn't see the reason because I think we just thought she would have said that. So I think we had kind of moved past it at that point. But I do understand we probably should have asked anyway just to get her her answer, but that is the reason why we probably didn't ask.
And I don't want to diminish what we do, but you and I are not trained journalists, and occasionally there are moments where you get caught up in just the humanness of everything, and that was a really emotional episode to listen to. I mean, she had her kids in the background at certain points. Like, it was tough to talk to her about her, you know, missing ex, the father of her kids, and, you know, occasionally you're listening as a listener, and you hear something, and then you have the, you know, the fortunate you can look back on it and say, oh, I would have asked that question. And there's numerous times when we've said that.
Yeah.
But you just don't think about it sometimes because, again, you're talking to a woman who's trying to deal with the fact that her ex is gone and the father of her kids is gone.
Yeah, and in addition to covering other cases recently, we have started dropping other show episodes in our feed. And that is because this network is expanding, and we as a company are kind of growing. And so you may hear some other ones, but just, you know, check it out. If you're interested, that's great. If not, you know what, just download it and delete it.
Yeah.
And you know, we appreciate the lack of complaints on this. We are, again, trying some new stuff.
And it's all got to do with the fact that we have the opportunity and the means to do this.
Yeah.
And the means being you guys, the listeners. If you keep consuming it, we have the doors open for us to do something better.
So. Yeah.
All of the new shows, if you hear it, all of the new shows are within the same vein. They're all trying to answer a question or help some sort of organization or movement.
Yeah. And check out Strange World on Travel Channel Mondays at 11 p.m.
Which is the fun part of all of this.
Oh, it is fun.
We finally get something to do where we can just sort of speculate wildly and goof off with a really cool guy, Christopher Garitano.
Here's one from Lindsay. She said, I wrote you last week, but I forgot to add in my email a theory / question that I'm wondering if it's been considered. Personally, I can't make heads or tails about what I truly believe happened to Maura. My initial thought has always been that she ended up in the woods, but now I feel that she probably did get picked up that night. I was wondering if anybody has considered the possibility of Maura's disappearance ending up like Brian Barton. You know, you probably know about his case already, but to sum it up, I don't know. That name does not sound familiar at all to me. She says he went missing from his apartment and wasn't found for several years, but when he was found, he was practically hiding in plain sight right near a very populated area in a churchyard. So I'm curious if anyone has considered this or looked at Brian's case as a possible theory / outcome. I would say I think countless people have considered that. As evidenced by some of the searches that happen up there yearly or maybe twice a year sometimes. People are searching that, you know, direct vicinity, and including us. We've been there doing the same thing. So I think that's definitely been considered. I don't personally think she's right there in that vicinity, but I do think it's a possibility.
Right. You can't dismiss any possibility that comes up. You can look at other cases like this Brian, you know, he was hiding in plain sight. I don't know the extent of that search, but every situation, every case is different and every investigation is different. And I mean, look at the Delphi murders. They had a certain composite sketch that was out there for a long time, and then it changed so drastically recently.
Yeah.
So there's a complete 180 in some investigation. It's really tough to use one investigation in one case and say, well, this happened over here. Has it been considered that it could happen over here? Well, of course, but the odds of it are pretty staggering.
Yeah.
When you think about how many missing people and unsolved cases there are in this country, the odds are not good that someone's hiding in plain sight. That you just hear about that because it's finally an answer to one of these things.
Yeah, it happens occasionally. Another question here from Lindsay. She said, you mentioned that there are things you can't share with the public, which is understandable. Is there anything shocking that you guys know and can't share? I don't think necessarily shocking. There might be some details, not like specifically about Maura's disappearance, but maybe about some of the people that have been discussed as possible persons of interest and stuff like that. So some stuff like that we've heard that would be quite shocking to you, I think. But again, not specifically related to Maura.
Right. Definitely some stuff that we've read.
Yeah.
And some stuff that we've heard has been unsettling,
yeah,
to say the least. And if anything happened that was shocking about Maura's case, I mean, I don't think we would hear about it first.
Yeah, we definitely wouldn't hear first.
You know, if that info came, we'd be learning about it pretty much at the same time as everybody else.
I think that's exactly true, yeah. And here's one from Kevin. Kevin says, I think it would be beneficial to hear FBI profiler Jim Clemente again. Do you think you guys can conduct another interview with him? He says, in my opinion, I think he can offer more credible insight on Maura's disappearance, along with details on a suspect who might have not been transient in a case where foul play might have been the culprit here. So interesting question, Kevin, and I would love to have Jim Clemente on again.
Yeah, Jim Clemente, open door policy, of course. His buddies, Bobby Chacon and Francie Hakes, like those guys, they're all welcome on the show anytime. But we had Jim on as an FBI profiler. He was not that familiar with Morris' case, and we wanted to keep it that way because we wanted to present him the information and just see what his initial reaction would be. Now, after he's familiarized himself with it, it would be really cool to get him back on. So
yeah,
anytime he wants to come back on, we'll definitely take that if he's got any information or any sort of insight into the type of person, you know, a deeper dive into the type of person that might have done something to Mora. Allie has a fun question. All these years later, this is still my favorite podcast. Thank you, Allie.
Thank you, Allie.
Right up there as one of our favorite listeners. Last summer, you did a show with Lori Bruno. Lori Bruno being the renowned psychic and
white witch
from Salem, Massachusetts. She said she believes something will happen in the case close to the end of 2018. Have you ever followed up on that, whether it was possibly that search that was done recently? I'd say, I don't know, with Lori, you can't really follow up. She'll follow up with you. She'll let you know. And I would say if anything happened with the case close to the end of 2018, I think that search was, you could take that as possibly what Lori was indicating.
Yeah, I think so. And Lori will throw out a lot of names and dates and things like that. And, you know, she doesn't bat 1,000, but she is eerily accurate on certain things. And so I would say that might be the case in this one. But as you mentioned, Lance, you don't really reach out to Lori. She reaches out to you, actually. So just by talking about her right now, there's a good chance I'm going to get a random phone call. That's usually the way it goes with Lori Bruno. And here's a long one here from Lisa. Lisa says, love listening to your podcast about Mora. The first time I heard about Mora's disappearance was when I saw it disappeared. Very strange case. She's speaking about some of the witnesses, and she said that someone saw what she thought was a person in Mora's car with a cigarette, which was probably a red light from Mora's cell phone. Was it just after the accident? That's her question. I think pretty soon after, maybe 5, 10 minutes afterwards, yeah. Or was it after she got out and assessed the damage? I don't know.
No, I think it was right after, just the way it reads, because Faith calls and says that she can see a man in the car smoking a cigarette. So if she's confusing Mora if she's just assuming it was a man and she can't tell the gender of the person and it was the cell phone, then I would assume that it's right after the accident and Mora's trying to make a call.
And I think Lisa's trying to put together that if it was just after the accident, could she have been trying to call the quote-unquote tandem driver? I mean, maybe. I don't know who she was trying to call, but we do know that no call ever went through because there's no service there. So she might have been trying to call a hypothetical tandem driver, but was not able to because there is no service there.
She might have been trying to call AAA, like she told Butch she had called.
Yeah, I think that's probably more likely, but that's just my opinion now. Here's one from Ryan. He says, I've been following your podcast since 2017. It became clear to me at a certain point that there are aspects of this case that you cannot talk about. How does that affect the way that you feel about the case moving forward? In the latter part of 2018, I did some deeper digging into the case online. I was really surprised by what I read about one possible theory surrounding persons of interest or even a suspect in the case, but I was not surprised that you did not cover it on the podcast, given the issue of liability and the ongoing investigation. Best wishes and thank you for what you do. From Ryan. I mean, if you do some digging out there, some of the message boards and stuff like that, you will see names. You will see hypothetical scenarios, you know, speculation, that kind of thing about certain people. We definitely try not to do that, at least in our old age here, Lance. In our experience days, we definitely try not to do that. There are some names like say the house that the Murrays dug up. Like, again, like we just talked about, we don't necessarily want to put those names out there because there's really no reason to bring them into it now if there's no body in that house, you know? Like, yes, there are weird rumors and even some actual documented crimes from some of those people, but not necessarily stuff we need to put out there at this time, I guess.
Yeah, I don't have much more than that to say. I mean, it's just a matter of trying to figure out what's the right way to put out information.
And trying to be responsible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's one from Jamie. She says, are all of the episodes of your podcast available on YouTube? That is a big yes. She says, and how does the Finding Maura Murray show fit in? Is that yours too? Yes, that is. And that is available on Amazon Prime or on Vimeo for our international listeners. Check that out. It's called Finding Maura Murray. Right now there's 4 episodes. It's a video documentary that we produced ourselves, not The Disappearance of Maura Murray, which you should also check out, but that's on Oxygen.
All right. Well, Abby here has a bunch of questions.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Her first question is interesting. There have been multiple unconfirmed sightings of Maura. For example, the Father's Day sighting in the church, the Cumberland Farm sighting where someone saw a woman mouthing, help me, in addition to others. I was recently reviewing the May 6, 2004 article of the Caledonian Record. In this article, Lieutenant Scarinza says the following, not only believes the witness information is credible, he also believes the man actually saw the Hanson, Massachusetts resident. What he's talking about there is Rick Forster's sighting down by Hummingbird Lane, about 5.5 to 6 miles away from the accident site. So her question is, what made him think that the sightings are credible? And do we think that they're credible as well? Curious as to your thoughts.
I wish I thought they were credible.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish we had more information to go on with them too. What the police have said is the last time she was spotted that we know of was right by the car. That doesn't mean that she wasn't spotted and it wasn't a credible sighting afterwards, but we don't know about that. But I would say that if she was spotted after that and it was a credible sighting, then we probably would know about that.
Yes. Yes.
So I would say that no, I don't think any of those are credible.
And I'm not saying that there wasn't a moment in the store where somebody mouthed the word help me to the cashier behind the counter. That could have been the case. And then that person sees something on the news, Maura's pictures there. Maura had a very recognizable, familiar face. You could see a brunette with dimples and say that that's Maura Murray. That could have happened. There actually could have been somebody mouthing help me. To not have any other follow-up on that leads me to believe that that probably wasn't Maura.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know about any, like, surveillance video of that moment. You know, like, I don't even know if that was really followed up on and taken seriously. We don't know.
I mean, we were told that everything that comes in is followed up on.
Yeah.
You know, to the point of how much do you follow up on this years later?
You know? Right, yeah. I mean, you can try to pull that surveillance tape, and if it's not Maura, you know, can you identify the people? I don't know. I mean, it's definitely a different operation in that case.
Yeah, and the Father's Day sighting in the church, I'm kind of fuzzy on that. I know that there was, like, a name that was signed in a book, so...
Yeah, I don't know about that one.
I'd say the overall, you know, thing to take from this is understand that there were sightings or reports of sightings.
There still are.
But also understand, like, people are still citing Maura as if she were 21 years old.
Yeah, I think they're picturing her at that age.
As a 21-year-old, yeah. So look into it because, honestly, like, if the more people who look into it, the more information that comes of it. But it's never going to end.
Yeah.
I think that's just something to take from this, is that it's never going to end. And
the sightings, you mean?
The claims of sightings, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Certainly until this case is over, then the book is closed on it, the sightings will always continue.
Yep.
And here's one from Claire. She says, I've looked everywhere to find the original podcast episodes you've done about Maura. Are those episodes deleted, or is there any way to listen to them? Well, Claire, thank you very much for the email. As of right now, the only place you can find them is YouTube, but also Stitcher Premium. Check that out. Stitcher Premium, $4.99 a month. Check them all out. There's 60 of them on there at Stitcher Premium. There's also 60 Creator Commentaries episodes, which is Lance and I talking over the first 60 episodes of the Missing Maura Murray podcast from years before.
And you can get a really sweet glimpse into the special kind of torture that we go through listening to this. But comedy aside, there is information in those early episodes that was not 100% accurate just because we didn't have all of the facts in place and all of the information accessible to us. So we get to go back and correct some mistakes and clarify some things that we just weren't aware of.
Yeah.
I know this isn't exactly a AMA or a Ask Us Anything email, but Frank here has a long email of different cases that he's talking about us covering. I just want to say, yes, we will absolutely look into all of these cases, and that is the purpose of rebranding Missing More Murray. Keep those coming. If, you know, do you know Valerie Percy's case? Do you know Chris Block's case? Keep those coming. We're going to highlight all of these, and at some point, yeah, we're going to try to make it a thing to cover cases like this.
Yeah.
He also says, Elisa Lam hasn't gotten the attention she deserves. I beg to differ. Please go check out Brain Scratch, John Lorden's coverage of Elisa Lam. He does a great job really humanizing it and taking out the speculation and the ghost story aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's our last one here from Pelfrey the Dog.
Pelfrey the Dog.
Yeah, she's got a few. Let's see. You read about the Father's Day sighting. She also asks about the Cecil Smith and John Monahan transcripts from the Oxygen series. Looking back at Cecil's interview, it seems that Cecil was pretty convinced that Mora committed suicide versus falling victim to any criminal activity. However, this is contradictory to Strelzin's statement in the civil trial that there's a 75% chance of conviction. What do you think the reason for this discrepancy is? And I think... Now, it is still really interesting that Strelzin said he thought there was a 75% chance of conviction, but I think the answer, you kind of answered in the question. I think because the New Hampshire State Police was going through a lawsuit in which they were trying to prove that they were close to conviction, you know, that's why he said that. I don't think he was lying necessarily. I don't know. I'm sure that he does believe there's a good chance of conviction in Mora's case, but obviously it's been about 10 years later and that hasn't happened. So I think the reason he said that is because he thought that they would get a conviction, but also because they had just won a case against Fred Murray about giving out information, and that was why they didn't want to give out information, was because they thought they were going to get a conviction. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's really tough to... Again, that's all. We don't have the inner workings of the law of the New Hampshire State Police and law enforcement up there. So I think it's also weird to say a 75% chance. I think it's weird to put a percentage on these types of things. But hey, I am not privy to the information, but I am in agreement with what you're saying, like the reasonings behind that.
Yeah, I think that makes the most sense in my head. She says, any chance you could have Deb, the dog handler, back on the podcast to explain what could have caused the dogs to be wrong in the house that was searched? I would love to hear her explanation, her expert opinion on the whole thing. And I think we did reach out to her but didn't hear back. Is that accurate?
Well, she has her, I guess, her protege, our buddy.
Yes.
Yeah,
Travis.
Travis, yeah. So, Travis D. So, He said that he would reach out to her. He said that she would love to come back on and he would reach out to her. And then we just haven't heard back. I think, you know, people get busy and just check in again and maybe we can get the two of them back on and they can try to explain what would cause dogs to have a false positive reaction.
Yeah, and do they think it's a false positive reaction? Question six here. Who is better at arm wrestling, Tim or Lance?
I don't know.
I'm going to go with Tim.
Yeah, you got longer arms.
And you also dislocated your left elbow.
That's true.
A few months ago.
So, yeah, lost a bit of arm strength there. So I do have my right, which I could try to work with. But
you mean you're wrong.
Am I wrong?
How is Eric the dog?
Number five, the question. Eric's doing great. Yep, follow him on Twitter, at SuperBallon1. He's a delight.
And Abby goes on to say, thank you very much, and I will be at the October 5th show in Brooklyn that we are doing with Maggie Freeling from the Disappearance of Maura Murray TV show from Oxygen. She is going to be there with me and Lance and Patrick Hines and Jillian Pensavalle of True Crime Obsessed, the true crime comedy podcast that is actually really funny and a lot of fun. So check out that show. There are links in the show notes.
That's at the Bell House, which is a familiar stomping ground for True Crime Obsessed, and that is going to be a ridiculous night.
It really is. So thank you very much for listening here, everybody. We really appreciate it, and we will be back next week.